Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, coming to you from the OU Israel Center in Yerushalayim. I'm your host Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Shabbat Parshat Ki Teitzeh. It is Thursday, the 11th of Elul, 5765, getting closer and closer to Rosh Hashanah. It is Thursday, September 15th. And let us begin, as we usually do, with Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. It's something someone said, how come you do it every week? And as I've said many times in the past, it is because of, quote, the matzav, the situation. In Israel, things just keep rolling along. Not such nice things are happening. Not that this is a major thing, what I'm going to say now, but it sort of, to me, was like icing on the cake. Earlier this week, as everyone knows, the Israeli army pulled out of Gaza. The Knesset, the cabinet, rather, made a decision based on the opinions of the rabbis that they consulted and the Supreme Court and the Knesset Law Committee not to destroy the synagogues in the abandoned areas. And sure enough, not 24 hours passed when the Palestinians, in their crazed enthusiasm over the disengagement and withdrawal, destroyed many of the shuls. I don't know if they destroyed everyone, but it was a terrible, terrible scene. Apparently, a spokesman for the U.S. State Department criticized Israel for not destroying the shuls. Why? Because Israel knew good and well that the Palestinians would destroy them, and it makes the Palestinians look bad. Therefore, Israel is to be criticized for that which resulted in the Palestinians looking bad in the eyes of the world. Get that? I don't. Therefore, Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Karaticha Adonai, Adonai Shima V'Koli, Tehiyena Aznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai, Imavonot Tishmarya Adonai Miya Amod, Ki Imecha Haslicha L'Ma'an Tivarei, Kiviti Adonai Kivata Nafshi V'Lidvaro Hocholti, Nafshi L'Adonai Mishomerim L'Boker, Shomerim L'Boker, Yachel Yisrael El Adonai Ki Madonai HaChesed V'Harbeimo Fedut, V'Hu Yifde Et Yisrael Mikol Avonotav, Achenu Kol Beit Yisrael Hanetunim Batzora V'Ashivya Ha'omidim Bein Bayam Uvein Bayabasha Hamakom Yirachem Aleihem V'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha, u'me'afela la'ora, u'mishibud l'geula, hashta ba'agala u'vizman kariv, v'nomar amen. Parshat Ki Teitzeh contains 74 mitzvot out of 613. 74 commandments. That's a lot. That's the most of any Torah portion. That is 12% of all of the mitzvot. That is more than six times the average for a sedra. This particular sedra is of average size, comprising a little less than 2% of the Torah, more than 12% of its mitzvot. And you can sense Moshe Rabbeinu approaching his death, frantic to review Torah with the people of Israel, the people who will cross the Jordan into Eretz Yisrael and set up life there, here, in the venue which God intended for Torah. And Moshe is almost desperate to continue his input so that things will come out as best as possible. And we're concluding the bulk of the mitzvot of Devarim from Parshat Re'eh, Shofetim, and now Ki Teitzeh with 74, many, many topics, many, many mitzvot, and we'll be able to take a look at some of them. But having so many mitzvot will give us an opportunity to examine the style, of some mitzvot. Diving right in, not at the beginning of Ki Teitzei, but somewhere in the middle, we come across a remarkable pair of verses. I say remarkable in the literal meaning of the word, that it calls for someone's remarks. And you're getting mine. Both well-known mitzvot, the first, Lo tacharosh b'shor uvachamor yachdav. You're not allowed to plow with an ox and a donkey harnessed together. Interestingly, taking a look at the words of the Chumash, you have b'shor uvachamor is, even though it's two words, with an ox and with a donkey, they are joined by the upper hyphen called a makaf, and that means they share a single word-like character, having one Torah trup, lo tacharosh, b'shor uvachamor, yachdav. As if that makaf, that upper hyphen, combines the ox and the donkey, illustrating for us what you're not allowed to do. Now, the Torah does not give a reason for this prohibition. The rabbis do. They use this verse and several others as the foundation of a concept in Jewish law known as Tzar Balei Chayim, cruelty to animals, or, looking at it from the positive side, kindness to animals, the avoidance of Tzar Balei Chayim. And most commentaries do not hesitate to define this particular prohibition and describe the fact that if you were to take an ox and a donkey and harness them together, their temperaments and their sizes being different and their strengths being different would cause discomfort or pain to one or both of them when they are harnessed for the same task. What about an ox and a horse? Forbidden. What about an elephant and a giraffe? You don't really expect to find those pulling a plow, but the basis of the question is the same. Is this a prohibition for an ox and a donkey specifically? The answer is no. Torah law includes all non-compatible animals to harness them together and was using ox and donkey as an example, a common example in the experience of the people. So too with plowing, other purposes are equally forbidden, and that means you can't take an ox and a donkey to pull your cart either. You can't even have a horse pulling a cart and tie a cow to the back. That's the prohibition of Lo tacharosh b'shor uvachamor yachdav. Do not plow with an ox and a donkey together. Plowing, the verb, shor, the ox, chamor, the donkey, together, are only examples. And we're talking not about rabbinic legislation or extension of this mitzvah. We're talking about definition as passed down to us in the chain of tradition, the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law, which defines this particular mitzvah as the three key terms, Charisha, Shor, and Chamor, as being inclusive. The very next verse, and sharing the same little parsha, rather than being on its own, is a very similar verse in construction. It also begins with Lo, thou shalt not, and a verb, in this case, Tilbash, wear, Sha'atnez, you shall not wear Sha'atnez, which is Tzemer Ufishtim Yachdav. So each of these two verses has a Lo, thou shalt not, a verb, tacharosh, tilbash, two components, bishor uvachamor, tzemer ufishtim, and the final word in each of these verses is yachdav, together. But look at the difference. First of all, wearing wool, linen are specific. You can take wool and linen and make a tapestry and hang it on your wall. Not a problem. You can take wool and cotton. Not a problem. And wear garments with a blend of those two fibers. Only wool, only linen, only wearing, or anything that's construed to be like wearing. As opposed to the previous pasuk, plowing, not necessarily, all activities included, donkey and ox, all animals included. Very similar construction in these two verses, very different in the way they are applied. Of course, the nature of these two mitzvot lends itself to that reality, that one is inclusive and one is exclusive. As I mentioned before, the plowing with an ox and a donkey is considered a foundation stone upon which the concept of kindness to animals is built. On the other hand, sha'atnez is one of your all-time classic chukim. A chok being a mitzvah that does not readily lend itself to understanding. It is gezerat hakatuv, gezerat hamelech, a decree of the verse, a decree of the king, and we are duty-bound to follow it. So perhaps the fact that these two psukim are not only one after the other, but they are joined in the same parsha, makes that message come across as well. And that is, our mitzvot include the chok, which I don't necessarily understand, and the down-to-earth, practical, common-sense law, rule, etc., etc., that I can relate to very well. Both of those are part of the body of halacha. I would suggest that it is the specific nature, the enigmatic nature of shatnez that lends itself to not having been extended to anything else, because you cannot apply any kind of logical process why it should include something else. I mean, there are many different attempts at explaining shatnez, and if we say that the use of the chief fiber of the animal kingdom and the chief fiber of the plant kingdom for the chief use of fiber, namely wearing garments, and we see this as God's reminder that he is the creator, and one should not say, I am the master of nature. You are the custodian of nature because God gave it to you to be that. But it's not yours. And one of the many mitzvot and concepts that remind us of that is shatnez, which is a forbidden mixture. And the concept, the idea of a forbidden mixture, includes the thought that each one on its own, yes, but it's not a blank check, do anything you want, this is your limit and this is your restriction. There are also ties in with idolatrous practices. There's also lahavdil, a tie-in with the service in the Beit HaMikdash, where the Kohen Gadol, and according to many opinions, every Kohen wore garments of shatnez. But I digress. Bottom line, two of the mitzvot in the parsha, the prohibition of plowing with an ox and a donkey, and the prohibition of wearing garments of shatnez, wool and linen together, are similar, but very, very different. And each comes to teach us something, and they're being taught simultaneously, or consecutively, or continually, or continuously, right, IP? I know here consecutive would definitely fit. The message comes across all the more strongly. I don't know how Devekus people relate to being referred to as golden oldies, but in the world of Hasidic music these last, 40, maybe 50 years, we certainly can put Devekus' early albums in that category. Here from their first album, is a song appropriate to the month of Elul. The words come from Psalm 27, which we say twice a day, from Rosh Chodesh Elul through Hoshana Rabbah at the end of Sukkot. Achat Sha'alti. Let me try to focus on something related to the mitzvot we had just spoken about. There are some, let's put it like this. Almost all mitzvot are presented in the Torah without a reason for them given. There are very, very few, like two or three, where a reason is actually given. And I don't even know if you could call it that, but let's say you can. One that comes to mind is Sukkot. Basukot teshvu shivat yamim, dwell in a sukkah for 7 days. Lama'an yedu dorotechem, so that your future generations will know that God caused you to dwell in Sukkot during the period of wandering in the wilderness. That seems to be a reason. But most mitzvot are not given with reasons. In this seder we do have, do not accept into the full nation of Israel, people from the tribes of Ammon and Moab, do not offer them peace when doing battle against them, as we are commanded to do other nations. Al asher lo kidmu etchem balechem uvamayim, because they were not hospitable to you, and they also hired Bilam to destroy you. It's a reason. Most mitzvot do not have reasons. Yet, some mitzvot readily lend themselves to a reason, where the sages who present these reasons hardly hesitate to give them. They hesitate a little, because they realize that the Torah doesn't say why, and the why God commanded it can include factors that are beyond our understanding on any mitzvah. But here, specifically, do not plow with an ox and a donkey together. Help a fellow unload his beast of burden. Help load a beast of burden, because two people putting a weight on it is less uncomfortable for the animal. There I go. I added a reason I shouldn't have, without making sure that everybody who listens knows that it's our addition of a reason. It's not necessarily the reason for the mitzvah, because the Torah doesn't say. But our sages were fairly comfortable in saying, look, we could figure out why God wants us to do this, that, or the other thing. Specifically, in this issue we were discussing of cruelty to animals. It would be cruel to muzzle an animal while it's working, therefore don't muzzle an animal while it's working with food. The Torah doesn't give the reason. I say it again. That's also in this week's Sedra. The Torah says, Lo tachsom shor b'disho, period. Do not muzzle an ox when it is on the threshing floor. Yet, the sages were comfortable in saying, I can understand this, and they not only gave that reason, they went for it and built upon it a whole concept in Jewish law. Then there are other mitzvot where we give up immediately and say, this is a chok, especially when the Torah announces, Zot Chukat HaTorah, this is the quintessential chok, Paraduma. Why do we have Paraduma? Don't even ask. And yet, many, many attempts at understanding the different facets of the mitzvah are there. I would definitely think Shatnez belongs to that category, where there's a lot of tiptoeing, more so than with Lo Tacharosh B'Shor V'Chamor Yachdav. With Shatnez, you have, first and foremost, this is a chok. Then you have an analysis that we're talking forbidden mixtures. When you're talking forbidden mixtures, it brings to mind milk and meat, and it brings to mind cross-grafting of certain plants, and mixing of seeds, and growing grain in a vineyard, and also plowing with an ox and a donkey together, by the way, and cross-breeding of animals. And Shatnez is sort of like a token, one from the animal kingdom, one from the plant kingdom, as opposed to the other mitzvot that are plant-specific or animal-specific. Looking at the whole picture, we get a message from God. Nature is yours. Up to a certain point, you got to follow the rules. And for His reasons, we can eat meat, we can drink milk, but we can't combine the two, because He said so. But meat and milk come from the same source. Too bad. This is a rule. But we still strive to understand things, even though we're told, back away, this is a chok, and you do it because God commanded. When we say, yes, I do this because God commanded, but I want to strive to understand Him better, then there are a lot of things that open up. So Shatnez, in our example, is loaded with ideas and with symbolisms. I don't know if any of them are called a reason, but they certainly give you something to think about. For example, the first murder in the world, when Cain killed his brother Hevel, terrible, terrible thing. Cain had offered an offering to God from the plants that he grew, and Hevel from the animals that he raised. A symbolic reminder of that first major interpersonal clash. Don't wear garments of shatnez. It does not explain the mitzvah, but it gives you a handle on certain things. And as I mentioned earlier, the fact that the Kohen and Kohen Gadol, in their service to God, wear garments of shatnez, that somehow represents an idea which you and I are not allowed to wear in our day-to-day lives. In some ways, it's the ultimate example of a person's domination of nature. And God said to us, I want the Kohen Gadol to show that and to represent that. Not you. Not you. Here the idea is one of many, and you don't wonder how can people think of it in such different ways. That's the nature of a chok, a common sense, logical kind of mitzvah. People are basically going to agree on the way they think about it. Think about that. To use another example from the Parsha of Ki Teitse, the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKen. Torah says if you happen upon a bird's nest on the road, in a tree, and there's a mother bird sitting, hovering over the nest, staying close to the nest where her eggs and or chicks exist, the Torah says you're not allowed to take the mother bird together with the offspring. But if you want to take the offspring, shaleach to shalach et ha'em, you send away the mother bird, and you can take the eggs and the chicks. Once you start talking about this mitzvah, you find you got a problem. Because it is shrouded in mysticism, according to some people. Some say it's a sign of mercy and kindness, others say it's specifically a sign of cruelty. It applies only to kosher birds and not to non-kosher birds, and if it was only an issue of avoiding cruelty to animals, then the mitzvah would refer to any bird, not just kosher birds. That's the nature of that kind of mitzvah. In other words, if you were to say kindness to animals, then you point to the one we've been talking about before, plowing with a donkey and an ox. Ah, donkey's not kosher, ox is kosher. The message there, according to many commentaries, is it doesn't matter whether it's a kosher or non-kosher animal. You have to be kind to it. You can't be cruel. If that were the case, the simple way to understand Shiluach HaKen, then it would have to apply to non-kosher birds as well. By the way, there's an interesting side point here, and I hope I'll get back to the topic I was talking about. The side point on Shiluach HaKen is that it applies to a lot more birds than we are allowed to eat. We usually think of birds subdividing into two categories, the birds we could eat and the birds we can't eat. Kosher birds, non-kosher birds, or Ouf Tahor and Ouf Tameh. But it turns out that we are allowed to eat birds which we have a tradition, a masoret, that they are considered kosher birds. The problem comes from the fact that the Torah lists 21 kinds of birds that are not kosher. All the rest are. Yet the Torah's list is one which we cannot readily identify. We know that birds of prey are on that list. So an eagle is not kosher, and a vulture is not kosher, and a buzzard is not kosher, and a crow is not kosher. And other birds which we sort of are comfortable with translating from the biblical Hebrew to modern whatever language. But then there are others we're not exactly sure, and therefore we don't trust ourselves to say, this is a kosher bird because it's not on that list. How do you know it's not on that list? How do you know it's not one of the family of X, Y, or Z? So we go by tradition. And therefore we eat chicken and duck, goose, pigeon, and dove, pheasant, and quail. I don't know if that's an exhaustive list, but those are basically the birds that we are allowed to eat because we consider them to be kosher, because they are kosher. And we can add to that list turkey with an asterisk, with a footnote saying that there are some communities that don't accept turkey because it was not a known bird and therefore there was no tradition about it. Yet mainstream orthodoxy and all of your certifying organizations consider turkey to be a kosher bird. And if a bird is kosher, the rules of Shiluach HaKen apply to it as well. Which means if you have a come across a pigeon's nest and you want to fulfill this mitzvah, it applies, provided it's not owned pigeons. It has to be wild, meaning in nature. And whatever other rules can be checked. In fact, there is a situation where pigeons build a nest on your eaves, under which some people drop by listening to conversations that they're not supposed to. There, it is in your property, and technically your property acquires that which is on it for you. But there are ways that you can turn this into a situation of Shiluach HaKen just to get the mitzvah. And there are some people who will chase away the mother bird in order to get the mitzvah, take the eggs in order to do what the Torah says, put them back and let the mother bird return. And I have it on eyewitness testimony that it happens, even though there was always this myth that I remember as a child that once you touch a human hand, touches an egg, a mother bird will not go near it. Apparently, that's not necessarily so. All right, what about sparrow? Sparrow is kosher. So, sparrow, the rules of Shiluach HaKen definitely apply. What about a peacock? Well, a peacock is probably kosher. A peacock is most probably kosher. People will tell you from having examined a peacock that it is definitely among the kosher birds. The ways that its toes are, and its claws, and its crop, and other signs of assumed kashrut of birds, but we do not have a masoret, an unbroken tradition, that we shecht peacock. Therefore, we're not allowed to eat peacock. However, since it is most definitely, almost practically, a kosher bird, the rules of Shiluach HaKen apply. Not so with an eagle. Eagle is definitely a not kosher bird. Ostrich is definitely a not kosher bird. Owl is definitely a not kosher bird. And others. And the laws of the mitzvot of Shiluach HaKen do not apply to them. One other item related to Shiluach HaKen, which is also interesting, and that is a dispute, we'll call it, between normative authority, halachic authority, and Kabbalistic thought. According to normal halachic guidelines, the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKen exists if you want to perform it. If you come across a bird's nest, and it's a kosher bird, let's say a dove, a quail, and you want to have pickled quail eggs for breakfast, or for, I don't know how long it takes to pickle quail eggs, but you want to have that sometime in the future, you have a mitzvah to perform, shaleach tishalach et ha'im, chase away the mother bird, ve'et habanim, and the eggs, or the chicks, you can take for yourself. And the mitzvah would be performed. Let's say you don't want quail eggs. Let's say it even bothers you to bother this bird and take its eggs. Why? Let the mother have the eggs. Then the normative halacha would say, just Smile when you see that and walk by. And don't disturb the nest. Mitzvah unperformed. The Kabbalistic school of thought says you are obligated to chase away the mother birds and take the eggs, even if you don't want them. It's something, as I said, Kabbalistic. It has to do with triggering mercy in this world from God by this act, which intrinsically is not merciful or kind. It's like doing a purposely cruel thing with Torah sanction in order to trigger God's mercy and increase it. If you don't follow that, I don't either, really. But it's a Kabbalistic idea, and it creates that situation. I think all poskim would agree you do not have to go on nature walks all the time and hunt for the opportunity to do Shluach HaKen, but when it comes your way, you either do it or you don't, or you must do it. Those are the two schools of thought. Let's listen to another piece of music, and then we'll explore elsewhere in this fertile sedra of Ki Teitzei. The song is called Adon HaShalom. The words come from a Friday night Zmira, which is said by some people right after Shalom Aleichem, I think before Kiddush. The words Adon HaShalom, Master of Peace, Melech, the King, Shahashalom Shalo, that peace is his. Borcheni v'shalom, bless me with peace. V'tifkod oti, v'et kol b'nei v'eti, v'et amcha beit Yisrael, and assign to me, to my family, and to all the people of Israel, l'chaim tovim u'l'shalom, that we should have a good life and peace. Adon HaShalom.
Ay melech shehasholem sheloy Borchei ni basholoym Oy 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 yadovoy nasholoy
Oy oy oy, vesi, yivko yidoy si.
That was Shlomo Cohen with Adon HaShalom from an album, a 3-CD album, called HaGedolim Shel HaZemer HaChasidi. It is 29 different Hasidic music songs. This is the last one. It's a collection. And, you know, since this primarily is an Erev Shabbat program, even though it's recorded and first broadcast on Thursday, it's already Lekrat Shabbat. A lot of people listen to it on Friday, and I even found out that people listen to it on Shabbat, but hopefully only non-Jews. That's another story. But I feel that Shabbat-related music is appropriate for the show, even if you listen to it at a different time during the week. This was Adon HaShalom. Let's continue into the Parsha. What I said earlier about certain words being inclusive and certain words being exclusive. Tzemer u'pishtim means only wool and linen. Shor v'chamor meant a lot of different animals. It is really so with the same words sometimes. Just like chamor. In the case of Lo tacharosh b'shor v'chamor yachdav, don't plow with an ox and a donkey together, means any animal. And just like chamor, in if you find the donkey of your fellow roaming around, obviously it got away and it's lost, you have an obligation to return it. That applies to all animals. So the word chamor is sometimes an example of animals, but sometimes it is specifically a donkey and no other animal, like the mitzvah of Pidyon Peter Chamor, the redemption of a firstborn male donkey. Only a donkey. You have a horse, it has a firstborn, and it's male. There is no mitzvah to perform. It's specifically donkey. The Torah was not using an example. It was using the only example of that mitzvah. In this sedra, you have the word bein, ben, bet nun, sometimes translated as son, S-O-N, as opposed to daughter. Sometimes it means child. The inclusive use of the word ben is any offspring. The exclusive use of the word ben is specifically a male child. So when the Torah in Ki Tetzeh tells us, Ki Yeshivu Achim Yachdav, when brothers dwell together, Umeit Achat Mehen, and one of them dies, Uvein Ein Lo, and he has no vein, ben, he has no what? No son, what if he has a daughter? Or a child, which includes son and daughter. Then you have a situation where there is a relationship established with the man's death between his widow and his brother. That relationship is either consummated in the Levirate marriage known as Yibum, or it is severed, the relationship, by a divorce-like proceeding called Chalitza. Before the woman is allowed to marry anyone else, she's required to have chalitza because her husband, A, had no children, and B, has a brother. If he doesn't have a brother, there's no yibum and chalitza, obviously, and if he had children, and that includes a girl. But the Torah tells us the word ben. So, the question, every time the word ben is used, you ask, does this include daughters as well, or is it meaning male offspring? Sometimes the answer is one, sometimes the answer is the other. The word yom, day, sometimes it means daytime as opposed to nighttime. Lulav and etrog are taken only during the day. If you take them at night, you do not perform the mitzvah properly, because the Torah said, ulakachtem lachem bayom harishon. Take unto yourself on the first day. Well, that's fine, because sometimes that's not the meaning of the word yom. As in Zachor et yom ha-shabbat l'kadsho, honor, remember the Shabbat and make it holy, the Shabbat day, And we say that mitzvah applies specifically at nighttime to the Kiddush on Friday night and Havdalah as Shabbat departs. Well, which is it? Can't have it both ways? The answer is yes, you can have it both ways. Each case, the word has to be known, not decided by you and by me, but it has to be known to be exclusive or inclusive, and that is the role of Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law. And that is a key message from many, many parts of the Torah, Ki Teitzei especially. Not only does Ki Teitzei have the most mitzvot in the Torah, 74, it is subdivided in an actual Sefer Torah by the tradition of Parshiot into the most Parshiot, 44. An interesting side study, which I alluded to earlier, is what mitzvot have their own Parshiot and which are together with others in the same Parsha. Right, that's a separate kind of issue. Let's just finish off with the fact that the last three psukim, the last Parsha in the Sedra, is Amalek. We read it and fulfill the mitzvah on Shabbat Parshat Zachor, but we should keep it in mind this week as well that there is a mitzvah to remember Amalek, and not just on Purim, but always. We go back towards the beginning of the Sedra to show yet another phenomenon related to mitzvot, which exists elsewhere, but when you've got this 74 mitzvot in Ki Teitzei, you're able to see a lot of different things about the dynamics of mitzvot. The Torah says, if a person shall have upon him a verdict of guilty for a capital offense, and he is executed, then in some of those cases, I'm adding that in parentheses, you shall hang the person on a post. Hanging, in this context, is not a death penalty. The person is dead already. It is a post-mortem procedure, which is part deterrent for the rest of the population and part atonement for the person's terrible sin, where death alone was not sufficient to grant him atonement. Those are also parenthetical remarks, because the Torah doesn't give that reason. That's part of the tradition. You shall hang him on a post. Lo talin nivlato al ha'etz. You shall not leave the body on the post, referring really to overnight, but rather you shall bury him on the very same day. Ki kilalat Elokim talui. Because you're talking about a human being that was created in the image of God, notwithstanding his sins, for which he was executed, and you shall not defile the land that God gave you as a heritage. That is a two-verse parsha, which addresses the specific issue of Sanhedrin, a court carrying out this added procedure after execution, the prohibition of leaving the body longer. In practice, it is said that what was done was a token, couple of minutes before sunset, take the body down and bury it, including the post upon which it hanged, on which it hung, and that was so that people shouldn't even see the post and say, ah, that's where so-and-so hung. In any event, there is another aspect of these verses which goes way beyond the convicted and executed felon, and that is the requirement to bury our dead and not any other method, no cremation, no anything else, to bury our dead, and to do it fairly quickly, not to leave the body unburied unless there's a very good reason for a delay. In other words, the text in the written word has a narrow application, someone convicted, executed, and hung, And the broader application to the burial of all of our Jewish dead is not mentioned in the written word, but is taught to us by the oral law. Again, I want to stress, this is not rabbinic extension legislation inspired by the Torah. This is part of the definition of Torah law. And there are other examples in the Torah as well. Did I mention plowing with a donkey and an ox? Just kidding. I know I mentioned it, and I'm sure you do also. Again, jumping around, just to touch another base. A young woman who is betrothed, erusin. In the olden times, this was done not just a couple of minutes before the actual chuppah, but it was done months up to a year before. During that period, she was forbidden to all other men and not yet permitted to her husband. If she has relations with another man during her period of erusin, knowingly, willingly, she's subject to a death penalty, either from heaven if there are no witnesses, or it could be actually carried out by the courts. If she has been found to have slept with a fellow, and it happened in a field far away from a city, then listen to how the Torah treats it. In that case, im basadeh yimtza ha'ish et hana'ara, if the man finds the girl, betrothed girl, and forces her to sleep with him, then he alone is punished with a death penalty. Vilana'ara lo ta'ase davar, nothing shall be done in punishment for the girl. Ein lana'ara chet mavet, she does not have the onus of a death penalty. Ki ka'asher yakum ish al re'ehu urtzacho nefesh, just like a person arises to kill someone else, kein hadavar hazeh, this was the same thing. Ki vasadeh mitza'ah, he found her in the field, tza'aka hana'ara ha'me'orasa, the girl, betrothed and maiden, called out for help, ve'ein moshi'ala, and there was no one to help her. Now the interesting thing about this is that we don't know what happened. It was in the field. We know that she had relations with a man. She could have been a cooperative partner in the relationship. But the Torah says, read my lips, listen carefully. The girl shall not be punished because the guy forced himself on her. And she screamed for help, but nobody heard her. We don't know if that's true. It might be true and it might not be true. Comes the Torah and says, assume it is true. Give her the benefit of the doubt. You cannot prove that she willingly committed this form of adultery, then we will say she was forced. If it's in a situation where she could have screamed and we would have heard her and helped her, then we have to assume that she didn't scream on purpose. But even then, by the way, without witnesses, this is in God's hands. It is not something that can be punished in a court. But this idea where the Torah is testifying, she screamed. You don't say to her, did you scream? Did you scream for help but nobody was around? You say, don't say anything. We know you must have screamed and nobody was there to help you. Therefore, you are the innocent victim and you shall not be punished. If, of course, she is punishable, that's God's business for her, but not ours. It's a very important idea, which can be generalized as giving people the benefit of the doubt. I think, even though there's a lot more to Ki Teitzei, we'll call it at that. We'll finish off with another one of the songs from that 3-CD album I referred to before, HaGedolim Shel HaZemer HaChassidi. And this one will be Kol Yisrael, the introductory part of a Mishnah for all chapters of Pirkei Avot. This Shabbat we start the last cycle of Pirkei Avot, the one where we have to double up the Prakim in order to make it before Rosh Hashanah. I don't mean to make you nervous, but we've got three Shabbatot before Rosh Hashanah. This week, Ki Taitse, next week, Ki Tavo, and the following week, Nitzavim. Rosh Hashanah is the following Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday. And we do this Shabbat, the first two chapters in Pirkei Avot. All six chapters are introduced by tradition with the partial Mishnah from Masechet Sanhedrin, Kol Yisrael Yesh Lahem Chelek L'Olam Haba, all of Israel has a share in the world to come, and it's a good message for the month of Elul as well. It does not mean that you will necessarily keep that share. You have to keep it, you have to earn it, you have to build on it, but everybody starts out with a share in Olam Haba. Tzalil Vazemer with Kol Yisrael. And on that note, I will wish you now a Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameah, and Shana Tovah.